The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. We're going to talk about a subject that is really very interesting and very new and very different. Cities across America could be transforming themselves. Our city may be one of them, could be one of them. There's a thing called urban agriculture. Maybe you've never heard of urban agriculture, but as example, out in Milwaukee, there's a guy named Will Allen, who you can't miss because he's 6'7" and a former basketball player, who's created the Growing Power Organization that has six greenhouses. They're feeding several thousand people. They did $500,000 worth of business. They hired 600 people at living wages in that city to create an urban farm. They don't just grow vegetables, they grow chickens. There's a thing in Philadelphia that is called honey from the hood. People growing bees and making honey in the middle of the inner city, creating businesses for people to make a living off of. It's happening across the country. It's just a phenomenal movement, and it could take hold here in Baltimore City. What would that mean? What would our city look like? The last time we talked to Paul Graziano, who is our housing director, we pushed a little hard on the issues of thinking creatively about our city and what it could be, rather than just saying we have 40,000 abandoned houses and 10,000 abandoned lots in the city of Baltimore. What do you do with them? It's not the same old give it to a developer and just let them build. Maybe we turn some of them into farms, creating a new way of living. Can we do it? We're going to find out about that. And I'll introduce our guests, Carrie Smith, Justine Bonner, Tony Gerassi, and Laurie Feinberg to you in just a minute. Have you join in this conversation. As you hear the story we're about to play, think about your neighborhood. Think about what it would look like in your neighborhood if that giant big brown field behind your house was a farm, or what you can conceive, or maybe on the roofs of the houses in the neighborhood that you live in. Other cities are doing something that they're actually putting farms on the tops of buildings. All kinds of things we can imagine that could all be real and change the way we live. Before we get into that discussion in real detail, I want you to hear about the story that we put together. We went out to talk to the founders of a thing called Participation Park over in East Baltimore. It was going to be a public art project, and activists took over a vacant lot. They didn't ask permission, they just asked forgiveness, and they took over a vacant lot and created an urban farm with people in that community. So let's hear a piece of that story first, and then we'll come back, introduce our guest to you all, and have this conversation with you.
I'm Nicholas Vishnesky. This is a project that we've been working on for the last 3 years, and it's sort of come out of a history of doing public art and community projects in Baltimore, particularly in East Baltimore. And sort of basic gist is that we wanted to reclaim vacant space and create sort of social and productive vegetable garden.
I'm Scott Brzozowski. And we are an artist collective called Camp Baltimore, and that initiated this project in collaboration with residents in the neighborhood. And the project is called Participation Park. The response has been really positive. I mean, everybody is happy to see it. I think lots of people get food, and lots of young people in the neighborhood come out and work and help, you know, to plant seeds, maintain the garden, and also to eat the food, because during the summer we were having a lot of cookouts on the weekends, and we would make salads and stuff with the vegetables. I think it's the response has been really positive. It's still a challenge to generate participation among residents, and I think because it's a lot of work. So that's why next year we're going to set up a small cooperative and actually sell vegetables to local restaurants and farmers markets, so that a few people can actually make some income doing it, and maybe that'll be more sustainable.
From the beginning, when we first started, we decided not to do a conventional organizing campaign with flyers and door knocking, but just to come out and demonstrate through action And being out here and talking to people on an individual basis about like what we're doing, what they think, and how the space should be developed. And so it's been a very dialogical sort of process. And I think that's something that doesn't usually happen with city planning. It's usually this sort of top-down form of planning that's sort of imposed on people. And we're sort of want to resist that and create some kind of space where people can develop the city and the sort of based on their own desires and aspirations. I mean, I guess it's sort of in opposition to the sort of speculative market in which land sort of is bought and sold and used. You know, people with the means to buy land can do what they want, and so it's sort of this, I don't know, emancipatory thing to just to be able to think that you could actually do something without those sorts of capital surpluses, and create the kind of spaces that you want to see.
And sure, yeah, if we had wanted to work through the city bureaucracy and everything, I'm sure we could have gotten permission to do this. But it's also just kind of, that's kind of legitimized. Like, by doing that, you'd be legitimizing private property. You'd be legitimizing this whole kind of hierarchical system that regulates space, that, you know, that governs space and the way that space is produced in the city. So I think this was, yeah, like Nick was saying, just really about self-empowerment and just kind of doing it yourself.
It's almost a half an acre of land. It's 12 vacant lots. And the first year we cultivated half of the lots. And then the second year we cultivated the other half. And we've gotten a lot of resources from the city through a sort of strategy of like white lies that we sort of fabricated to sort of avoid eviction, you know, like, oh, we just basically telling that we have permission and the sort of the disorganization that exists within the municipality sort of let us get all these materials. And we tried to reuse some of the materials that were dumped here too. There was a lot of old mattresses and stuff that we turned into trellises for peas and cucumbers. There was, you know, old building materials that we, you know, used 2x4s to build composting bins and old pallets for composting and stuff. And if you walk over to the far corner, you can still see people still dump at that corner of the lot. There's a bunch of old couches and just moldy debris that I guess and whoever dumps there. We also recently had a huge pile of backfill dumps. It was just solid clay. And so it was a huge, it was like a, how many yards? It was like 10 yards. And I guess another obvious thing or important thing to the project that I didn't mention is that there's no fence. It was very important to us to not have a fence because we wanted to be this sort of inclusive space where people could come in and out freely and glean what they wanted and then come and help as much as they wanted. So there's sort of this ideal situation where there's sort of this reciprocal sort of shared labor that happens where people come and help maintain the garden and then take what they need. We sent the soil out to a lab and they tested it and there was low levels of lead, safe to grow in. And we started to follow the recommendations for remediating the soil. There was a we needed to add a lot of organic material because there was only a few inches of topsoil. It was low in all nutrients, phosphorus, nitrogen, potassium, all those things we had to add. And we've been trying to do it all organically, so which has been expensive.
Herbs are doing very strong. These are lettuces here. This is romaine. And over here is mint, thyme, and this whole entire row is herbs. Mint time. We have marigolds placed everywhere. They sort of seed themselves, but then beyond that is basil, dill, sage. And then over here you have a whole row of beets. And we had tomatoes growing in all four of these rows. We grew a variety of, I think, about 40 different kinds of heirloom tomatoes this year. We're big tomato fans, and everyone seems to really like a good tomato in the middle of the summer. I'm Dane Nestor. and spring is really intense, but you know, in the spring and summer, we're here every day, and if not for like whole days at a time. You know, the first year none of us worked. We worked on this full time, and so we were out here 8 hours a day every day.
I live in Johnston Square. Both of us live in Johnston Square. I'm a disabled veteran, and so that's how I got into Johnston Square. You know, obviously this is not one of the better neighborhoods, but you know, this is where I have to live. You know, and so why not? You know, where I live at? Why not take care of where I live at? You know, I mean, we need for our elected officials to come down here and actually see. You know, in all this urban blight. You know, you got an oasis of greenery right here, you know.
That was a piece that we produced from a story we did this fall, and talking to people who, early in the spring, talking to people who put this farm together on the east side of Baltimore, right up by the penitentiary. But we're talking about something that comes out of that, that is even larger than that. As I said earlier, you can go around the country right now. There's in Oakland, they have something called City Slicker Farms in Oakland, California, where they're building farms. You can even go to a website right now, and it's called citychicken.com. I looked at that this morning, and I was just blown away by the amount of urban poultry farming that is taking place in America. We're going to talk about all that and more. In the studio with me is Carrie Smith. She's Assistant Director of Community Greening and Stewardship Program at the Parks and People Foundation. Justine Bonner, for the last 9 years, has been a flower and vegetable gardener in Sandtown, feeds her family and families around her with her garden. Tony Gerassi is with us. He's Baltimore's new director of food and nutrition in Baltimore City Public Schools and is a pioneer in this work of having sustainable gardening, sustainable food, and having our children in our schools eat healthy. Laurie Feinberg is division chief in the comprehensive planning unit at the Department of Planning. And folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Number is 410-319-8888. Join in on this conversation. Think about your neighborhood. Is it insane to think about farms in the middle of Baltimore City that feed our citizens? People make a living at farming. Could it happen? How insane is the idea? Tony Gerassi.
Well, I don't think the idea is insane at all. As a chef, and as the director of child nutrition for the city of Baltimore, I know the single most powerful tool that you can use to teach a kid about food is to plant a seed and watch that child watch that seed grow into a plant that then turns into a fruit or a vegetable that they harvest. And then they take that fruit or vegetable and prepare it for their friends and they eat that. And it forever changes the way they look at food. It's no longer a consumptive act. You know, you can show pictures of beautiful tomatoes all day long, but until a kid plucks a cherry tomato off of a vine and pops it in their mouth, still warm from the summer sun, that moment stays forever.
The first time we talked to you, you told this incredible story about working with kids in our schools and as the head of nutrition and food in our schools and of introducing young people to a peach.
Yeah.
They had never had a fresh peach.
Look, that little moment blew me away. I was at this school, and I sat down with these two second graders, and they had peaches for the very first times in their lives. It was the very first day of school this year, and this one kid was sort of rubbing this peach across his cheek, you know, and I was saying, look, it's supposed to feel like that. The other kid was sort of smelling it and sort of looking at it, and then finally, this one kid just bit into it, and there's like peach juice. These are tree-ripened, Maryland-grown peaches, right? And this peach juice is running down his face, down his arm, onto the table, and this wave of emotion came over this kid's face for an 8-cent peach. It forever changed the way this kid looks at food, you know? This is something that we could do. This is something well within our power to change. And it's something that we're certainly doing in Baltimore now in the public school system and a lot of other schools around the country. I'm working with the 20 largest urban school districts in America, and we're sharing some of these ideas and sharing our strengths. And, you know, our little farm, we have a 33-acre farm out on Route 40. And it's in the heart of Babylon. It's surrounded by fast food places. places and strip malls. But this place, it's got bees, it's got goats, it's got chickens, it's got, you know, stuff coming out of the ground. Our kids are growing and planting their own school gardens out of this little farm. And it's, you know, it's an amazing process.
So I'd like to get the kind of your vision, the rest of us at this, in this panel, about this idea that you could actually have urban agriculture. I was talking to Beth Stromer, was going to be on this show, who works for you at the Department of Planning and who works on the Sustainability Commission, started working all this, and we have a very forward-thinking group of people in planning who are saying that this could actually be part of Baltimore. We have to change zoning and some other regulations, but this could actually happen. Let's talk about the vision that you all have. When you think about this, Justine Bonner, and you've been gardening on your own in Sandtown, your own plot, feeding your family and feeding neighbors with the food you grow, the idea that that could actually expand into being a way to feed citizens of Baltimore City. What do you think of that idea?
I think it's feasible, especially during hard economic times like the ones that we are experiencing now. Mm-hmm. More and more people are looking for a place to grow their own food, to supplement their income, and also to provide good nutrition for themselves and for members of their community. Plus, there are many people in Baltimore who have the skills already. They were attracted to Baltimore because it was an industrial town. So they brought skills with them from rural, usually southern areas, and all they need is an opportunity to use them.
Carrie Smith, I mean, I like to, and Laurie Feinberg, I mean, I want to talk about your perspectives on the possibility of how this changes the fabric community. I mean, we've had community gardens, which Justine Bonner has been part of, and many people have been part of in this town for a long time. Larry Close is one of the great master gardeners of Baltimore, has taught a lot of people about this, growing food for their neighbors and for themselves. But people are talking now about the idea, whether it's rooftops or abandoned land, creating urban farms to grow food, employ people, and sell the food to the citizens.
Well, I think it's not only feasible, but it's happening now. And when you look at all the really the superstar inspirational programs like in Milwaukee and Holyoke, Massachusetts, that are these huge, exactly what you described, and you trace them back to their beginnings, and they started like Participation Park, and they started like Bragg Nature Center and Fresh Start Farm. They started like Roy Skeen working with a nonprofit in South Baltimore. That's how they started. They started from the grassroots, and they just grew and grew, and these things are growing now, and people are hungry, no pun intended, for learning how to do these things, how to grow their own food. I think it feels good to be able to rely upon yourself, particularly in difficult times. And through Parks and People, we've hosted workshops on composting, and the response is huge. It's just people want to know how to do it. They want to start doing it. They just need people to tell them how, and they're off on their way. But it's happening. And through the Urban Agriculture Task Force that we have been hosting, there's over 80 people involved, and they've already having an urban agriculture gala in April to celebrate spring, to celebrate growing, to celebrate agriculture. So the interest is there, and it can't do anything but get bigger in Baltimore City.
Laurie Feinberg, I mean, we always think of governments are getting in the way, but at this point, governments doing just the opposite here.
Right. The Office of Sustainability is working to identify a startup farm, looking at something in the 10-acre range that would be able to get started as an urban farm, and then that would support smaller gardens and farms around the city, sort of the mothership, so to speak, mm-hmm. Because some of the support functions wouldn't be feasible in smaller places. So we're looking to do that and then be able to help support neighborhood gardens and institutions and identify areas. Also, as we rewrite our new zoning code, which we're in the early phases of, we're looking at identifying categories in zoning, you know, that varies with the neighborhoods that would identify places that would be appropriate for gardening or more commercial farming versus residential.
I'm going to hear what our listeners think. I want you all to imagine a future in our communities here in Baltimore, Prince George's County, where we're listening from, where urban agriculture could be a possibility. We're going to walk through some of the different ideas, how that might work. The idea of actually, like in Red Hood, Brooklyn, they have turned it into a program that turns gang kids around to becoming urban farmers and changing the nature of their behavior through that work. There are all kinds of possibilities here. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Join our guest, and Jacqueline in Glen Burnie, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Thank you for taking
my call. I just had a comment about community gardening. I am from California, from a town called East Palo Alto. It's about 30 minutes south of San Francisco and Oakland. And we had our very first farmers market open last year. We do not have a grocery store in our city. We have to drive about 15, 20 minutes to get to a grocery store. All the stores that are in the town are liquor stores or sell junk food. And the group that started the farmers market is an organization called Collective Roots, and it's held at a charter school, and the kids, they take care of the garden, and they have so much fun doing it, and they get so excited when they tell people about their garden, and they always want to invite people to come and participate in nourishing a city that's, that has high rates in asthma and diabetes, and they like educating their neighbors about food and showing them proper ways and how to eat and how to be healthy. So I really big advocate of community gardens and this agribusiness or whatever it's called. It just needs to keep growing.
Jacqueline, thanks so much. It's a great story, and I think that, and I wonder how these things really do kind of transplant themselves, no pun intended, to places like Baltimore, and how these things really work.
I think that Baltimore is this great city with enormous resources. You know, this is a city of like 138 neighborhoods, and every neighborhood is different, and every neighborhood has its own sort of style and flair to it. But the resources here are deep, and your last caller had talked about kids and how proud they are of putting their gardens together. You know, we've forgotten as a community the importance of giving our children responsibility. Like, we have this expectation that they're going to be great citizens, but we don't give them any citizenship skills. And just the simple thing of stewardship is this amazing skill that is transferable, that really sort of changes kids' attitudes about their place in the community. One of the things that we found with our older kids mentoring younger kids, putting together their school gardens, the little kids can't wait to be older to sort of like take on the responsibility of stewardship. You know, these are great transformational tools. And in a city like Baltimore, where we have these vast food deserts, and when I say desert, I mean the only real food that's available are in like supermarkets that are miles and miles away. The only access to food is through like small neighborhood bodegas and stuff. There's no fresh food there. So it's critical that we start developing a system of greening within our city so that fresh food is available and accessible to everyone.
For this to really work on a large scale in a place like Baltimore, I mean, don't we have to think very differently about what it means to develop a city, what a city looks like? I mean, when you look at, I was reading today more about what's going on in Milwaukee and where Will Allen is, and they have 3 dozen full-time workers, 2,000 people who are working as volunteers on their urban garden. They have 6 greenhouses, 8 hoop houses for greens, herbs, and vegetables. They have goats, ducks, turkeys, chicken coop, beehives.
Yeah, baby.
They're growing tilapia and perch. And we already have somebody in downtown Baltimore at the University of Maryland Center on Pratt Street that is really has the patent on how to raise fish in urban areas in vats, as opposed to putting them in the water, so they're healthy farm-raised fish. But we'll come back to that later. But so you have people like the Growing Power organization I just described, and that's kind of a vision of where what could happen here. So what makes that happen? How does that happen? How do you employ hundreds of people in urban agriculture? How long does it take, and where do you start?
How do you... I think it's like the development of the infrastructure of this thing. So you have all of these gardens that are growing around town. What do you do with all of the fruits and vegetables and things that they're growing? So here in Baltimore, I'm currently in the process of building a central kitchen for the school system. So we get back to like cooking from scratch. I just recently wrote the first RFP in Maryland history calling for only Maryland-grown fruits and vegetables to be purchased by the school district. Now, the school lunch program has this $40 million a year sort of economic driver, you know. In the state of Maryland alone, public schools, not universities, not anything else, are like this $800 million a year industry, you know. So, you know, all of those dollars can stay here in this state. This state is a wonderful state for growing things year-round, but how do you get it to the kids in the middle of winter? You have to create processing. So part of the school central kitchen is about processing. And part of the model of that is to make it a community kitchen. So everybody knows, Mark, you make the best salsa in town, right? But what do you do with that? So you, from your garden, you could take your peppers and your chilies and your onions and garlic and come to the central kitchen, process it, can it, label it, package it, and then boom, you're in business. You're now, you know, Steiner's Salsa Supreme, you know, on the street.
I'm ready now.
Yeah, so it's creating these opportunities so people can take advantage of, you know, business opportunities and entrepreneurial experience.
So if we think and envision this city 10 years out, we're in the middle of economic crisis. Sustainability is the buzzword of the moment. Is it insane to think that Baltimore, I mean, I'm just going to lay it out, Baltimore could feed itself?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Is it insane to think we could feed ourselves?
I don't think it's insane. I think it's possible. But it is. It's going to take a holistic shift. And there's got to be, you know, the purchasers to receive all the produce that's grown and all the fruits of the urban agriculture labors. And I think having Tony and people from the institutional end demonstrating that it can work, and the restaurants that are currently buying locally grown foods, like I said, it's happening now, and I think it's just going to continue to grow. But if you think back decades ago when we had local specialized, you know, butchers and produce sellers, and we had an infrastructure then, so it's not impossible. I think it will take time to shift that way, and it does have to happen more on a holistic level.
Justine Bonham, before we go to break and we go to our phones and all these people have called in, we want to get them on the air with us. I mean, I'm just imagining you in your garden, and how you think about this in terms of this kind of futuristic discussion where we could go, and for something you strike me as a woman with a great deal of wisdom, so I'm curious what you think.
I think it's possible, but... like Carrie said, it's going to require a holistic approach, because while you're able to do things on a small scale, and most of the community gardens are on small parcels, things like delivery systems are not an issue.
Right.
Even preservation is not an issue. But in order to make it work for a large group of people or for a large tract of land, then these are some of the things that would have to be worked out.
And I also, as we go to break here, Laurie Feinberg, I mean, it's going to take some serious discussion and zoning changes to allow vegetables to be grown or animals to be brought in.
The animals may be a challenge. I think the vegetables will be a little bit easier for people to accept in their neighborhoods. But we see the city's role as more to try to incubate this. It's like other businesses that we've done incubation in previous enterprises. And this concept of a sort of mothership farm would be the incubator. And then hopefully the market would take over from there.
We're going to take a very short break and come back. And we will go right to the phones and Rob and Jay and Lee, our first three callers up. We're going to come up to your thoughts. Number here is 410-319-8888. I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they are still there, helping people in difficult times. So go to MECU.com for more information. We'll be right back as we look at urban agriculture coming to a city near you, maybe our city. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're talking about urban agriculture this hour. There are people in this community, like Ted Rouse and others, who actually think that we could turn parts of Baltimore into large urban farms on rooftops, in greenhouses, on land that exists, hiring hundreds and hundreds of citizens of Baltimore to work those farms, to harvest the food, sell the food, can the food, and create a new industry in this city. Other cities are doing it. It could be the wave of the future, or we can be part of that wave. We're joined this hour by Kerry Smith, Assistant Director of the Community Greening Stewardship Program at the Parks and People Foundation. Justine Bonner, who is for the last 9 years has grown flowers and vegetables in Sandtown, Winchester, taking care of herself, her family, and her neighbors. Tony Gerassi is the new Director of Food and Nutrition with Baltimore City Schools, is transforming the way our students eat and the whole way they look at food. And eat food, I should say. 410-319-8888 is number here. Laurie Feinberg is Division Chief in the Comprehensive Planning Unit at the Department of Planning. 410-319-8888. I said we go right to the phones, and Rob in Annapolis, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me. An absolutely wonderful topic today. Tony, I met you at the last Future Harvest Conference in Frederick this past year, and really found you inspiring talking about Baltimore City and all the wonderful things Baltimore City is doing. I wanted to let the listeners know that the Future Harvest actually has a publication that helps folks, kind of points folks in directions of where they can get local grazed beef and chickens from their local farms to help support farmers within the state, and all this poultry is produced sustainably. So I wanted just to let folks know about that. And my kids go to school in downtown Annapolis, and I would love to see them learn from what Baltimore City is doing, and hopefully down the road Tony will share some of his wisdom with all the rest of the folks in the state, and hopefully they'll follow his role.
Well, it seems that what's going on in the schools, I mean, is kind of a microcosm or a foundation to look at what can be built. I mean, the question I have for all of you in this is, can food be grown in cities or even in relationship to farms outside of Baltimore in our metropolitan area, where sustainable food could actually be affordable for the regular working people of this community?
Absolutely.
I mean, because right now, if you want to buy a free-range chicken, you're paying more money at Whole Foods or some other place for that chicken. You don't buy organic food, costs more.
I think that we need to sort of reassess how we look at food and how we value food. So in this country, we spend 25% of our income on healthcare, and we spend 5% of our income on food because we have this cheap sort of, you know, corporately raised agro-food. In many other parts of the world, they spend 25% of their income on food and less than 5% on healthcare. Funny how that works.
Why?
You know? Well, because I think you are what you eat. That's the bottom line. If you're eating good, healthy, organic, sustainable sort of food that, look, your body was meant to absorb nutrients through whole food, not through pills, not through additives, not through fortification. It's like you get iron from greens, baby. You don't get it from a pill, you know? So your grandmother was right. You need to eat your greens and go out and play, you know? We need to sort of change the way we act and interact as people, you know, and get back to some fundamental things that are about healthy living and healthy lifestyles.
And the question though still remains, I think that is true. But can sustainable agriculture, whether it's urban or not, allow regular working people to buy that food? I mean, that's what I want to get to. I mean, it's, you know, when you do mass farming of this industrialized food, it's cheap. So your peas are less than they are if they were buying organic peas. How do we work urban agriculture, other kinds of agriculture, where people raise chickens, and as they do in other cities, I think people don't have roosters because roosters wake people up and have another issue, but people do have chickens. I think you were saying as we go to break, we went to break in
Portland, Oregon.
Portland, people can have up to six chickens in their backyard. So what about, I mean, what about the how much have you looked at the idea of the affordability when it comes to sustainable food?
Well, on a smaller scale, I think there's a lot of things that people can grow themselves in their own backyard or in their neighborhoods that are not expensive. It's not expensive to purchase seeds or soil or vegetable starts.
No, what I'm talking about is this whole idea of having urban farms. Mm-hmm. In other words, are we going to have a situation where urban farms grow food and they're sold to restaurants and they're sold to stores, but the people living around the corner can't afford the food? That's what I'm talking about.
Well, it's about access again, you know. So the average grocery store in America has about a 2.5 day supply of food on hand. So if anything catastrophic happened in this country, do you know where your food comes from?
Well, it would be tough. You'd have to grow your own or run out to the farm.
Yeah, so
and
I think that
some.
So when we talk about sort of like rethinking food and rethinking how this thing works, I mean that's sort of like the core of this thing is sort of thinking in terms of what's good for us as a community. I know in your garden that the nutrient value of the food that you grow is far superior to those things that you see on the shelves, mm-hmm. because the soil has been stripped of all of the nutrient value, so you get these sort of hollow things that look like tomatoes, but there's nothing there.
Cardboard,
there's no
tomatoes,
yeah,
as I call
you know. So it's again sort of rethinking this process and looking at so if we're gonna like grow food and consume food, that the food that we grow and we eat and we consume needs to take care of us, needs to nourish us. So. You know, again, it goes back to, you know, looking at the source of the food again and ensuring that there's nutrient value there.
Laurie Feinberg.
Just briefly, one of the principles in the sustainability plan is also looking at delivery systems. And I think someone mentioned that before, and that would likely affect the affordability, mm-hmm. hopefully down the road, because what you pay for in the Giant, in some cases, is the cost. Many times, especially as gas prices go up, it's the cost of getting the food there is more than the food. So if you're reducing the delivery costs, that should affect the affordability down the road. And using the economic power of institutions like the public school system can create that sea change.
That can make a shift, and like you did with pizzas in
to
the
create
schools.
The market.
Right. Justine, do you want to say something before we go to the phones again?
One of the problems, I think, is probably the start-up cost in terms of doing the farming on a large scale. Now, I know that the government has financed a lot of food campaigns when we've had difficult economic times. For example, we had the relief gardens during the Depression. We had the Victory Gardens during World War II. If this were to happen in Baltimore, then some entity would have to come in, aside from just declaring that a certain tract of land would be available. Mm-hmm. Then there would be other things that would have to be done. In order to make it affordable, then you need people who are either going to do the work on a volunteer basis or a barter basis. They will trade a day's labor for the ability to get some of the produce that is grown. But some people may not be able to do that. So you have to find a way that you can make it feasible for them to be able to purchase the foods in a sustainable way, not just this week or maybe next week, but over a long period of time.
I mean, that's become the key of all this. Let me, before we turn back to internally, I promise to go back to the phones, 410-319-8888. We'll go to Lee and then Leroy. Lee, you're on the air.
Yes. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, I'd like to commend you for having another wonderful show and this very timely issue. My father, years ago, was a pioneer in that urban garden, him and his friends in Lower East Baltimore. Mm-hmm. When the city had a policy, they would tear down houses and have a in between the middle of the row homes there. And he and his friends would go in and put in a vegetable garden. And that was something that they used to do a lot. It was throughout the city. But I was just saying that this is something that we may really have to really embrace. And given how Parks and Recreation is doing with the rec centers and the closing the centers, we might want to start with Clifton Park. I was a lifelong resident of that area. And years ago, when I was a kid, it was full of activities with the baseball diamonds and the fields. And you don't see that no more. You might see an occasional soccer game, but that's it. I'd feel that, you know, so... I don't know, but I think we need to really be thinking along those terms. And I'm just going to hang up and say thanks again for bringing us another educational program.
Thank you, Lee.
Well, I have to say the city has been a wonderful partner in this process, and they've identified and helped us to identify several plots around the city, like big plots, 10-acre plots, 15-acre plots. I know my buddy Ted Rouse is all over this hoop house idea. And a hoop house –
hoop house is a what?
A hoop house is a very energy-efficient greenhouse, and it's a portable structure that you can set up and take down anywhere, but you can grow an enormous amount of food in a very small space year-round, requires virtually no energy to make that happen. There's sort of a thermal layer in between the outer skin and inner skin, and there's a very low wattage fan that sort of forces air through. So you're using like thermal energy, solar energy to sort of heat the plants that are in the inside. And these things work. I mean, I just did a conference up in Michigan 2 weeks ago, and it's cold in Michigan. And these guys were putting out these amazing blackberries in the middle of the winter there, you know. So it's a great model. It's an easy model to work. And again, I have to say, the city of Baltimore has been an extraordinary partner in trying to put this stuff together. They're about it. As I understand it, Sheila's putting a vegetable garden on the front steps this year, right?
Yeah, she's put the other
pre-Obama, already, I think.
Yeah, they're already planting vegetables in the beds in War Memorial Plaza, working in partnership between the city and the Baltimore City Master Gardeners to plan vegetable gardening. And I agree, again, I mentioned other post-industrial cities that are successfully growing year-round. I've been to Chicago and Detroit in the winter, where microgreens are being grown and things are being grown all year round. They're teaching communities to grow in their own neighborhoods and also doing it on a larger scale.
I mean, in some places, there are trying New York City, other places, vertical farming, where people are growing in hothouses and cultivated land on roofs, their own food on tops of buildings.
There's a restaurateur in New York now that has greenhouses on top of buildings in Manhattan that he provides all of the greens for all of his restaurants. I think he has three restaurants. And that's cool stuff, you know? And it's something that, that works, and it's out-of-the-box thinking. And Baltimore's got all these great resources here. You know, we could absolutely be the model for the nation around a sustainable urban agriculture project here.
Laurie, Justine, you want to jump in before we get back to the phones, or should we just go back?
Okay.
410-319-8888, Leroy in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, Leroy.
You know, my grandfather was a botanist, and he installed a green thumb in me at an early age. However, it kind of dissipated as I grew up. But once I attracted diabetes in my later age, I went back to my holistic way of life. So at my condo, I basically have a greenhouse on the back of my patio.
Uh-huh.
But my question is this. In the urban environment, such as Baltimore City, which has a big problem with rodents, would that cause a problem that takes us back into the Stone Age with plague?
That's a really serious question. People talk about infestation, crops, especially if you grow corn, other things that could attract rodents, and how you deal with that, and how other cities deal with that when they have that. Any thoughts on that here?
I don't know. You know, I was born and raised in New Orleans, and some of the wharf rats there are bigger than dogs around where
I'm standing in Baltimore. So, yeah. They have big ones too. But I mean, I think the issue is, I mean, I've heard some places that the articles I was reading about Philadelphia today said they didn't have any problem with rats in their gardens, and kind of protect the gardens from kind of any vermin would come in. But people have had problems with people stealing tools for sale in the communities, and people taking. Have there been a lot of problems like that in your gardens?
We've had some. Mostly they take the plants. So we have learned to plant a row for them and a row for us. So we're sharing, even though it wasn't planned sharing.
Are we talking about the thieves or the rats?
We're talking about the thieves.
The thieves, right.
The two-legged rats.
The two-legged thieves as opposed to the four-legged thieves. Leroy, that's an interesting question. I'll tell you what. This is just the beginning of this discussion about sustainable farming and gardening in our future. And we're going to do some research on the question of vermin and the problems of that. If you're raising chickens, if you're raising other animals inside of city, if you have corn growing, those are real issues. Now, I grew corn on my front lawn when I lived in Windsor Hills. Some of my neighbors liked it, some of them didn't. But we were able to keep the rats out. We had fences up and they didn't get in. But I mean that it can be done. But we will look at that. 410-319-8888. Gary in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
Hi, Gary.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the affordability. And I currently work for a high-tech greenhouse down in Anne Arundel County.
Mm-hmm.
But I've done a lot of research on growing basically lettuces in a high-tech environment. And in about a 9,000 square footprint, you can grow about 300,000 lettuce a year. So, you know, for not a lot of space, if you do use the proper technology, which is available today, you know, it was even available a decade ago, you really can, you know, produce enough to outweigh the cost of production, really.
And that is really the issue, Gary, that I was trying to get to earlier, to make things affordable. I mean, there's an old vaudeville joke, you know, how do you do it? Volume. I mean, because you grow enough to keep the expenses down. And that's always been my concern about how you make small-scale sustainable agriculture work for the farmer to survive and also for the consumer to afford. I mean, that's the bridge I really want to see answered.
And there's a broader picture here that your dollars that stay in the community keep your community vibrant. It keeps it strong. Keeps your neighbors employed,
yep.
Keeps the tax base, you know, affordable for everyone. Again, it's sort of like looking at this thing with a local eye. So in Baltimore City, public schools, like one of the reasons why I drive the notion of local purchasing is because I think that the tax dollars should stay with the taxpayers, that the taxpayers should always get the best bang for the buck, you know? And when I wrote this RFP calling for only Maryland-grown fruits and vegetables, I wrote it in a way that my colleagues in every county in this state can piggyback off of that same RFP so we can create an industry here. I'm working with Jane Storrs at the Department of Agriculture right now to turn a wholly underutilized processing plant out on the Eastern Shore into a place that we can start packing sort of Maryland's best for all of the schools here and
so
lower
the schools
costs.
Then buy from that place collectively, not collectively necessarily, but they buy
right.
together, brings the cost down and
creates
forces,
jobs,
right.
Keeps the tax dollars within the community, and then creates an economic model and driver for like all of these other springboard operations.
I wonder, Laurie, if we're and Carrie, if are people planning and thinking about what this means long term? I mean, we talk about a 10-acre site to look for in the city. But thinking long term about strategic thinking and planning about how this could actually grow in a city like Baltimore.
Well, I have a couple of thoughts. One, when we talk about doing things more creatively and thinking holistically, I believe now that there are programs where people who receive food supplement benefits can use their benefits at the farmers'
vouchers,
markets.
Yeah.
So creative programming like that and evolving what programs and assistance currently exist to include locally grown food. And the second is comparing to how where people are getting food from now, there are areas of Baltimore City where there are no supermarkets. So it's not an alternative between shopping at a supermarket and buying at, you know, the Whole Foods. They're buying at corner stores. There's just not there's not a healthy or appropriate source of any kind of food, whether it's a vegetable or whole grains. It's just not there. So how much they are spending, what they have, what disadvantaged people are spending what they have is not efficient currently. So it may be the opportunity to solve some other problems that have been existing for much longer.
410-319. Did you want to say something before we go back to the phone?
Just I think that the city is, again, in looking at the startup garden, when we can see how it goes, and then smaller gardens may be something that move and shift around with the economy. So, you know, my understanding is they can kind of pay back in a few years, and if development changes in one area, you can move a garden, you know, after a few years. So that may be able to keep that flexibility.
Let me go
so
back
that we
to
can
the
put gardens where we need.
Right. I think we have somebody who wants to respond to the question of pest control. This is what they have to say at 410-319-8888. Robert on Valley, you're on the air.
Yeah, for the gentleman to ask the question, if he Googles integrated pest management, there are ways to deal with rats and other pests without using toxic material. Trapping is a very good way, and building some of the barricades to keep them out is another way. And but the ideal way to manage rats is with snakes, you know.
Ooh.
They keep the rats away from vegetables. As well as out of the chicken house.
Corn snakes.
Well, black snakes too, but folks don't want black snakes in the yard. But that's the ideal way if you want to manage them.
That's a really smart way, especially in a small area. Because, I mean, corn snakes and black snakes are not harmful to human beings. They don't, they're not venomous. They're constrictors, and they go after small rodents. And that's they've always been on the farm.
Yeah.
Always.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Robert. Glad you joined us with that. 410-319-8888. And Brian in Columbia, Maryland, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Brian.
I was on your show one time, a long time ago, on that other station talking about genetically modified organisms.
Okay. But, yes.
great to be on your show again. But,
good to have you back.
I'm an organic farmer in the area, and there are a number of farms that are producing produce. A number of farms operate like mine, community supported agriculture, and there are two sites that people can go to find out about this, marylandsbest.net and localharvest.org. And we are the thing is, we need to think about growing food and building this infrastructure, because unlike making television sets, we don't have a choice about eating. And with fossil fuels being depleted, we are all going to be faced with growing food wherever we can possible. I just want to say one other thing. I'm a recent graduate of landscape architecture program, and I think that we need to rethink our ideas of cities, to not think of them as dirty places where you can't grow something that you're going to eat because of all these cars driving right by. We need to design our cities to be growing places themselves from the beginning. And when we tear down vacant buildings, we should integrate agriculture into the rooftops and all around, along with stormwater and all types of green technology.
No, I think we're on it. We're in a place now where we can reimagine this city. We can reimagine what it can look like, what it should look like. And I think there's an interesting mix going on here that actually has potential. I mean, we have a mix of, I think, of a community activists, a school system, community people, and very progressive thinking people in our city government who are trying to think about how to do things in very different ways. I mean, and your role in planning is critical, because you're going to have to recommend the zoning changes, the planning. I mean, you're like the crux of, we look at housing apartments in Graziano and all the other stuff, but really you're the folks who make the recommendations about how the things really change.
Well, absolutely. The idea of thinking of this...
Well, Brian, before we run out of time, I just want to let Laurie Feinberg real fast answer that question from our planning department.
Well, we hope to involve all of this and include all of this in what we hope will be a state-of-the-art zoning code. We're in the process of getting drafting now, and we're actually, I'm leaving here going to a community meeting about information on the new zoning code and some new ideas on form-based coding, which is not directly related to agriculture, but we'll be working throughout 2009, and we're getting a lot of input from groups interested in urban agriculture. So we're very excited to have the state-of-the-art product ready for Baltimore in this area.
And it sounds like the school system and the work you're doing in the city schools is something that connects up with communities and with people like Parks and People. I mean, it could be part of the fundamental underpinnings of creating a new urban agriculture movement in this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that my job as the director of food and nutrition is more about putting healthy kids in front of educators ready to learn than stuff on a plate. And this really is sort of a down payment on a universal health care system for our city. You know, good food, accessible food, and locally grown food.
So are we on the cusp of something here, do you think, in Baltimore?
Absolutely.
Or do you think that this is something that really is, you know, we want to shift the discussion from this kind of pie in the sky, which I don't think we've done this hour, but to, well, we're trying to wrap it up. We'll have to do this round two sometime very soon. Kerry Smith, Justine Bonner, Tony Gerassi, Laurie Feinberg, it's been a pleasure to have you all here. Go to our website, steinershow.org, so you can learn more and connect to the things that we have been talking about this hour. Thank you all so much for being here. It's been great.
Thank you.
Inspiring. Remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. And for more information on personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Also made possible by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, the Urbanite Project's in its third annual experiment in the power of unconventional collaboration. And Urbanite's available in print at more than 800 locations around the Baltimore region and online at urbanitebaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered today by Mike Nice. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, and Brian Boone. Our theme music today is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Keep farming and take care.
Hey, thanks, Mark, for having me.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.